get yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. They brought death to hometown, boys. Death to hometown, boys. Death to hometown, boys.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to have a guest. Discussion is going to be on the U.S. union labor movement. What's happened to it? And some folks that are trying to resurrect it. The labor fight back group out of, pretty much everywhere, East Coast and so forth. And I have a guest today. I'm not sure if he's on yet. Alan Benjamin, longtime union activist in a whole number of areas, union areas and immigrant rights and so forth. Alan, are you with me?
I am. Thank you, Jeff.
Okay. Alan's with me. Let me just make a few preliminary comments here. We're going to be talking about a conference held by these folks, grassroots union folks, organizers, and rank-and-file members, and some officers, and so forth, trying to resurrect the labor movement, which is moribund, to be polite. There hasn't been a major labor strike or effort that I can recall in 20 years. It's been the last I recall of any real significance was in the mid-1990s when the UAW struck at Caterpillar and the Teamsters went out and reformed the union with the UPS strike and reform and takeover of the UPS leader there, took over the Teamsters Union, won a major victory in the UPS strike, and then, of course, the powers that be, both within those who were on the outs in the Teamsters Union, together colluded with the government, and they did this fella Kerry in and drove him out after he had won this significant fight at the UPS, the parcel drivers, 100,000 of them, major win for labor. But that's the latest major win of any consequence that I can think about. There have been some occasional local victories here or there, in transport, local transport companies, rail companies, and subway companies, workers, and. Very, very few, though, and very localized, and most of it has been a massive retreat by labor, which now in the private sector represents, I think, barely 6% of the total workforce, the lowest it's been in well over a century. Even in the 1920s, it was not that insignificant. And, of course, the influence of organized labor has pretty much deteriorated as a consequence of that collapse of union membership in the private sector. Of course, what are the reasons for that collapse is a very, very important question. Part of it is a very sophisticated and effective employer offensive. What we had in the beginning of the 1980s was the deindustrialization, opening up the global markets for U.S. Multinational corporations who then just moved their jobs en masse, first to the South, then to Mexico and Latin America, then to Asia and elsewhere around the world, pretty much gutted all the high-paying manufacturing jobs that used to exist and create a decent income for folks in this country. And the representation of unions in those industries, which were really like 70-80% unionized, collapsed as a result. And other aspects of the employer offensive were important as well, the deunionization of those who still had unions in the U.S. proceeded. On top of that, we had the shift to low-paying service jobs, which were difficult to organize because they're very small, The creation of what's called contingent jobs, part-time temp contract jobs, that followed the offshoring of jobs in manufacturing as well. Today we have maybe 40, 50 million people who are part-time temp contract, sometimes called the precariat instead of the proletariat. This is a global trend, but of course the laws then said that if you're part-time temp, you can't even be in the union, or you can't vote in union elections and so forth. So that gutted organized labor. And now we have the gig economy that's come along, a very nefarious kind of trend in which the employer owns the software, controls the customer, and isn't even required to provide the tools, the fixed capital. The workers got to provide their own fixed capital, their cars, right, or their trucks. Now, you know, the Ubers and the Lyfts for the cars are now migrating to trucking. We got a million truckers in this country, and in the next 10 years, probably half of them will be gone, and much of what's left of the Teamsters Union will be gutted as well. And we have even worse trends going on. The whole new business model we got with Amazon destroying jobs everywhere, creating some jobs in warehouses. But just look at what's happening to retail, which were contingent part-time jobs. But even those are going away now. Where are people going to enter? Young people going to enter to get jobs when they come out of school? You know, these jobs are just disappearing. There's no place to go to. Everyone's trying to put together little gigs, part-time here, part-time there. You know, in academia, which has been gutted. A million jobs, you know, 70% now are part-time lecturers. So it's not just in the private sector, it's in the public sector. The e-commerce thing, the Amazons, and the tech industry itself, you know, people don't understand how the tech industry is destroying work culture in the United States, destroying jobs, you know, e-commerce, gig, all of that is a result of the tech industry. Bringing in hundreds and thousands of skilled workers from India and elsewhere, and dumping any training of American workers for those jobs. And of course, you know, Americans graduating, citizens graduating, are losing out hundreds of thousands of jobs to foreign nationals. Skilled, Trump talks about this immigration thing, and that's mostly low-skilled folks from Latin America and Asia coming in, taking jobs that Americans don't want to do. I mean, how many people want to graduate from high school and become dishwashers or servers in restaurants, or pick fruit or other, slaughterhouses and so forth? How many want to cut up chickens? Not many, many. But a lot of these folks coming in low, unskilled. Our folks are taking jobs, not from Americans, but jobs that you know, they don't want. But when you get these H-1B people, L-1, 2, L-2 visas coming in from Asia, they're taking hundreds of thousands of jobs that people want. And what do you got here with Trump? His latest announcement, he's attacking immigrants, low-wage immigrants. At the same time, he's, if you look at that bill and that proposal, opening up more possibilities for the skilled to come in and take, software engineers and other tech jobs, and opening up what's called the, I think it's EB-5 jobs, where if you bring in enough money, you can get instant citizenship. Yes, people don't realize that, but if you come in with money, what is this money doing when they come in and get free citizenships, mostly from Asia? What are they doing? Are they creating jobs with it? No. They're bringing in money, and they're buying up high-end houses with it and driving up the price of housing, which drives up the price, particularly on the West Coast here and other places on the East Coast, drives up the prices of rent, and people can't afford to live anywhere in the cities. The San Francisco Bay Area is just a mess in that regard. working class folks are being driven out of the Bay Area, having to commute hundreds of miles just to get to a job in the Bay Area, and homeless people are multiplying by leaps and bounds. That's the consequence of these visas and this whole policy by Trump, where if you're rich or you're highly skilled, yeah, you can come in and take jobs, but if you're poor and you're willing to take jobs that other people aren't, from Latin America, for example, no, we don't want you. Well, all of these things together combined, and there's more of them, have been destroying the union movement, destroying jobs, and the law is being finessed here for these new categories in the labor markets not being eligible for belonging to unions. And in the whole process, we have this major labor market change, revolution going on, just as we have a revolution in financial markets going on, making the wealthy 1% filthy rich, richer and richer. We got these labor market changes that are making average working class folks poorer and poorer. Well, in the process, the union movement has been virtually destroyed. It's time to resurrect it. And this brings me to my guest here and the Labor Fight Back Network, a very important development and group, which just had its latest conference and developed a number of programs and positions here, kind of a programmatic gadfly to the union movement in this country, which if it doesn't make significant changes in the next decade, it will be gone altogether. That's my own personal opinion. And I speak from someone who has been an advocate and participant in the labor movement, the union movement, all my life, for over 40 years, with a number of different unions as an organizer, contract negotiator, a local union officer, and so forth. So I'm not some academic who's raising this red flag, and neither is my guest, Alan Benjamin, whose credentials at the grassroots are even more impressive. Alan, sorry for that winded introduction, but I just had to throw out, you know, my perspective on this and why the labor movement needs to go through another resurrection. And it's not the first time. Organized labor in its whole history has had these resurrections and recoveries and come up with new ways and new forms of organization and new strategies and tactics and restores itself. And in my view, it's at another one of these junctures. These are total new rethink and restoration. I think the folks at Labor Fight Back Network are trying to address this, and in their latest conference. So I'm going to turn it over here to my guest, Alan. Again, apologies for my long-windedness, but had to get my perspective out here. Tell us what the Labor Fight Back Network is and what happened at this recent conference.
Okay, yeah, thanks. Thanks, Jack. And just as far as your assessment, it's bleak, it's accurate. It's the challenge that faces those of us in the labor movement to understand, as we do, that the labor has still, despite its weaknesses, and its their weaknesses are growing by the day, the potential power, still has the potential power to turn things around and to enable working people and all oppressed peoples to take action in their own name, in their own interests. It's potential, but for that we need to reclaim our unions. We need to, as you say, resurrect the labor movement. And the Labor Fight Back Network is a component where activists, rank and file, middle layer, a number of top officers in unions. Baltimore Velasquez, who's on the National Executive Board of the AFL-CIO, is part of our work and was there. He's the president of the Farm Labor Organizing Committee based in Toledo, Ohio, and he's organizing farm workers in North Carolina. To add to your list of horror stories about what's happened to labor or what's happening at the hands of the corporate interests, Baltimore is facing a new law in North Carolina that prevents his union from collecting dues from their members through paycheck deductions. So that if they want to collect dues, they have to go into the backcountry of North Carolina and collect individual dues from members. But most important, second thing that he brought to our attention at this Labor Fight Back conference in Cleveland just two weekends ago was that all new workers will be banned from joining the union. The union will be, those who are currently members can continue to be members, but all new hires will not have the right to collective bargaining or to unionization. This is the most draconian measure yet, which outright bans unions. It doesn't just make it impossible for them to function. It would ban them. And Baltimore said, we're not going to be shut down. We're going to challenge with mass actions, with protests, with boycotts. We're going to rebuild the Labor Community Alliance. And he asked us for our help. And we said, we're going to be there at your side and lighting a match under the butts of all the labor officials who should be doing something, not only around this, but one of the big issues that we're facing is a national right to work or a federal right to work law. The right to work is a euphemism. We call it right to work for less, which essentially so guts union organizing. It's what exists in the South. It essentially bans the closed shop, the union shop, and has given the employers free rein to do whatever they like in the South. In fact, the South is, to add to your list of woes, the South is becoming the new maquiladora, the new sweatshop region in the United States, with Renault and other companies coming in as they came into Canton, Mississippi, to build with Ford to build these new cars. And workers were severely threatened with losing their jobs. Company would shut down if there was a unionization drive, and the workers, majority of workers, voted not to unionize. This just a couple of days ago. And it was under the tremendous pressures that you're talking about, Jack, of the employer assault, feeling that at least they had a job and they couldn't afford risking losing their jobs and having the company close down and move to some other state, North Carolina, or moving out of the country. So the assault on the labor movement is the greatest I have ever witnessed. And I know that it was great in the 1920s, but it's ferocious. It's just unyielding. And so the business unionism that worked, so to speak, for so many decades, the glorious decades in the post-war period after World War II, is just not only insufficient, it's fueling the corporate assault, the capitalist assault on workers, unions and their rights and their gains. So we're facing in the labor movement a huge challenge. Either we reclaim the traditions of struggle that built the unions, think of new strategies, build new strategies, or we're dead. Now, the situation is not necessarily from the point of view of fight back, Jack, as bleak as you picture. There have been a lot of strikes. There's been local. There was even a regional strike of Verizon workers that succeeded in beating back the corporate assault. And I would list that as perhaps something different than occurred, than the pattern that you lay out since the, UPS strike. There was a huge uprising in Wisconsin where workers occupied, public sector workers, teachers, students, youth, fight back, occupied the Capitol in, what was it, 2011, I believe it was. And it was a genuine occupation of a state capital to demand the unionization of public sector workers and an end to the Walker law that would ban it. Of course, that was not the failure of the power of the workers. It was what failed in Wisconsin was the deals that the union officials, the union bureaucrats made with the Democrats and others to betray the movement and to take it off the streets, out of the courthouse, and into a recall election where the alternative that was raised, that was put forward by the Democrats was a union-busting mayor of Milwaukee who everyone hated. So the willingness to fight has been there. The May Days, the struggles in 2006, not that long ago, people came out in the street in millions to support undocumented and documented immigrant workers against the whole, you know, assault. There's been the fight for 15 and the union. It's a movement of young people. And it's tied to sort of a revitalization in the black community of the Black Lives Matter and people struggling against police brutality. There's been, even since Trump came to office, there's been rallies and there's been actions, not by the organized labor movement. They've been missing in action, though rank-and-file members have been out in force. So the challenge is to reclaim, we call it reclaim, our unions for struggle. And in that sense, we don't pretend to be the union movement. We don't pretend to be Labor Notes, which has, you know, a big hearing. We consider ourselves a wing, a social union wing, an independent politics wing that seeks to talk about our experiences and to distill from them what's wrong and what can we do to change it, and can we come up with a few campaigns that begin to move the ball in a different direction. One of the things that we noted, Jack, was that there's a tremendous opening right now for independent politics, for working class independent politics. Black working class candidates are running against Democrats and Republicans all over the country. People are flocking to things like the Richmond Progressive Alliance, or in the case of Mississippi, the Chokwe Lumumba for Mayor campaign running against the establishment Democrats. We noted that, and we had the participation in Cleveland at the three-day Labor Fight Back conference of a wing of young organizers who worked for Bernie Sanders and who have created a movement to draft Bernie for a new People's Party, who feel that the Democrats cannot be reformed, that Bernie is misleading this movement by trying to continuously pretend that the Democrats can be reformed, only sowing disappointment and demoralization, and that the people who really look to Bernie for guidance, because he raised a lot of important issues such as single payer. And by the way, there's a whole very important movement across the country for single payer health care. And I would say one of the more dynamic wings of the labor movement today is the labor movement that surrounds the labor campaign for single payer. This is a very real movement, Jack. It's at all levels, and it's trying to say that single payer needs to be in passed now, and we have a good opportunity with the total crisis in the Republican Party over this, and the failure of the Democrats to really put forward any alternative, because Obamacare is not an alternative; it's a private insurance alternative. So we've brought together serious people representing you know, a very strong wing in the black workers' movement. And we're kind of taking a page from their leadership. People like Chris Silvera from the Teamsters, National Teamsters for Black Caucus, Clarence Thomas from ILWU, people who are talking about organizing mass strikes on May Day next year and building already, or they're talking about building labor contingents in the Reverend Barber's Poor People's Campaign, or the initiatives we mapped out seven major campaigns around healthcare, and one of the major ones was around the issue of canceling the North American Free Trade Agreement and linking that with the fight to stop deportations and to support farm worker struggles both in Mexico and in the United States. And in that sense, as you your readers may know, or listeners, I'm sorry, next Wednesday, the talks are opening to renegotiate NAFTA. And this is the whole contradictory aspect of what people saw in Trump. Trump played the anti-NAFTA, anti-free trade card and said, you know, these trade agreements are killing working people. And he's right. The Democrats, he said, are the main organizers of these trade agreements that are decimating workers' jobs, and he was right. And he gave a very populist rhetoric to say, I'm going to be standing by working people. And, you know, one of the first things he did was go to Carrier in Indiana, one of the corporations there, and pretended that he was saving jobs when, in fact, Carrier is not saving workers' jobs. 1,200 of the 2,000 jobs are being offshored, and other carrier corporations across the country of United Technologies are offshoring their jobs. So it was just one big con job. And the biggest of it is this NAFTA renegotiation. It's a sham. Trump wants to pretend to save American jobs, but he's incorporated into this renegotiation proposal all these provisions from the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement that are only going to make offshoring more likely, that attack workers and their rights more severely, both in Mexico, Canada, and the United States. So the whole renegotiation is not about protecting workers in any of the countries. It's about promoting corporate interests. And so we decided one of the things we want to do is make a very concerted campaign against the Democrats and Republicans to say we need to cancel NAFTA. We need a new deal. That's a precondition for any new deal that actually benefits working people in any of the three countries. And for that to happen, working people have to be the motor force of any new trade agreement. They have to be not only input, but active participants in helping to fashion a new trade agreement that protects jobs, that protects labor rights, that doesn't build a wall along the border that separates people, but tears down that wall. Capital under these agreements can cross borders. Well, workers should be able to cross borders freely as well. So these are some of the things that we're raising, that we're putting forward in campaigns and resolutions that some of us are bringing forward to the National AFL-CIO Convention at the end of October in St. Louis. And what's exciting, Jack, is that a lot of young people are coming to the conferences, linking up with us, saying we want to be part of the of a labor rebirth. And you're seeing this with different forms. 25,000 young people in flock to the Democratic Socialists of America. Now, it's not what I believe is an alternative, but they're raising, shouldn't we have a labor party? Shouldn't we run our own candidates? Shouldn't we be breaking with the Democrats? Now, that was not the line that won, but a lot of the young people are raising these things. So there's the rebirth is not going to take place just in the labor movement. It's going to take place among It's taking place this resistance in opposition to the boss's two parties and their politics is taking place in the community allies. And what we have to do is help funnel that into the labor movement and build the labor community alliances that are going to be able to help transform the union. So it's a tall order.
Let me comment on that important point. I think you're absolutely correct that there is agitation from below. There is workers of various kinds, discontent, and exploring ways of resistance, and young workers in particular, which is the hope here. But that kind of makes the point that I initially set out to say at the start of the show, and that is that kind of agitation by workers and rank and file people, independent politics, the Richmond Progressive Alliance, and so single payer Medicare, all of these things is where the activity is. But the unions, the official unions, are way behind the curve. They are still content, as you said, to continue with the business unionism approach. And as they have been driven into near oblivion, the problem is they have sought to protect themselves, and this is the consequence of business unionism, by appealing to the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party, as they get weaker, pays less and less attention to them. We could just see the whole Obama phenomenon since 2008. I mean, he kind of just said the unions and their positions and their needs were he ignored them from card check to the very end here. The unions themselves, the structure of the unions, is in my the way they are structured today. And the way the law has been built around that structure to prevent anything but collaboration, they are not the vehicles. You know, I say that as somebody who still defends unions and for 40 years, you know, have been active in various ways at the grassroots. I'm not making an argument against that, but I am saying, and you made my point, that all the real resistance is coming from outside the official union structure. You mentioned Wisconsin in 2011, and that was a good example of resistance from below that was then captured, encapsulated, and directed into the wrong strategy by the top union leadership, who wanted simply to continue collaboration with the Democratic Party. And I believe that collaboration is a major element in why labor is where it is today and near destruction, at least in the private sector. And of course, the offensive is intensifying across the board against the official union structure here, right? You mentioned this whole dues collection thing with the Farm Laborers Organizing Committee. Well, that's happening everywhere. Texas legislature is just voting on a law to do just that. In other words, no unions, not even open shop, where no one has to join the union if they don't want to. Now even those who do choose to join the union, it's they're going to get rid of dues collection, dues deduction, checkoff, they call that, right? Right. And that's going to devastate the unions even more. It's not just open shop anymore. And you mentioned now open shop anti-union offensive is moving from the state level to the national level. That's true, right? It's another new Koch brothers initiative here, right? And this whole idea of new workers being hired after the election are barred. They can't even choose. They're barred from joining the union. In other words, this offensive against the unions is intensifying. And, you know, management and the big capitalists aren't satisfied with just debilitating the unions. They want to wipe them out. And they're well on their way to doing that. Part of the problem is union leadership at the very top, I'm not talking about rank and file and local unions, but the very top is largely responsible, not totally, because it's the offensive by the employers is the fundamental thing. But this whole collaboration thing with the Democratic Party, who ignores them, continues, and that's the death knell here. If that doesn't stop, you see what happened with the collaboration in Wisconsin through 2011, right? I think,
Jack,
everything the resistance has to occur from outside the union structure, and those progressive elements inside will follow it. But I don't think it's going to come through the unions, because the way the union structure has evolved, it is hopelessly business unionism, and the laws have been structured, you know, the legal system structured to prevent, even if you want to, and even if rank and filers want a democratic union and are able to temporarily achieve one, well, what you got is the Kerry phenomenon.
I'm going to differ with you on that, Jack.
Good.
And let me tell you why. I believe that much of the ferment is taking place in the black youth, among activists fighting for single payer. But some of that, as I mentioned in the case of single payer, or in the case of the fight to defend public education, for example, a lot of that is taking place within the unions. The structures are not so, in my opinion, stacked against you that it's impossible, as you say. It's difficult, and it's making it constantly more difficult as the laws are changed. But I believe that it's still possible to turn things around, and that it's going to be from within and from without, and not just from without. From within, there are huge movements. I could go into this at length within the teachers' unions to fight back against the privatization onslaught by DeVos and against the policies of collaboration with Democrats and with the, you know, with the authorities, with the administration, in the gradual gutting of public education through vouchers and mostly through charters. There's a rank-and-file insurrection within the teachers' unions in California. My wife, who's a president of a teachers' union here in San Francisco, is part of that. There's meetings, there's caucusing, there's an opening. It's not easy. What I guess I'm trying to say is that I totally agree with you that the collaboration with the Democrats is really the source of the problem, or it's one of the sources, because it's what's enabled all of these laws and free trade agreements and the whole shift further and further to the right. And the workers are presented with, you know, the lesser evil. It's this whole lesser evilism that's moved the pendulum away from our interests, and we're constantly voting for lesser evils who just a few years ago would have been considered the main evil. It's moving at alarming speed, as you say. But the problem is that we cannot, that within the unions there are people standing up to fight back. And the unions still, one of the weaknesses of the movements that exist is that there's no labor involvement. It's the strength, in a sense, mm-hmm. because they're not beholden to any agenda. They can actually speak their own mind and act independently. But the weakness is that they're isolated and alone. They need the potential power that they need the unions and the millions of dollars that they still have. In France, keep in mind, the unions only represent 6%. But when they mobilize, they bring out the entire working class, because people identify and understand that they're speaking and acting on their behalf. So the numbers don't say the whole thing. There's still the immense millions of dollars that are used for the Democrats could be put to the service of organizing. There's the resources, the human power, that Democrats couldn't elect anybody if it weren't for the Democrats, for the labor movement and their foot soldiers. So we're saying that potential power has to be used in the interest, turn things around in the interest of working people in alliance. The key point that we made throughout the weekend is partnership, alliance with our community allies, taking our leadership from them, because frankly, that leadership will inspire our members and workers. When they see the teachers union in Chicago fighting, it was because they linked up with the community. And they did reform their own union, Jack, in Chicago, so that they built and organized with the input in their contract of their community allies, not just their members. So things small, there's small little changes that point the way forward. There's some caucus movement, rank and file movement in the unions that point the way forward. There is movement around the fight for 15 in the union that is possibly a way forward. There is the labor campaign for single payer, which is very dynamic and which does things, organize things, builds big support with the community. And do I think it's enough? By no means. It's a small portion of the picture. As you said, the overall picture is bleak, but we want to look for those small points of support, those leverage points, and build those alliances with the forces in motion. Consider building new structures in the process so that they're more amenable to community participation and involvement. Workers' centers and others that enable people to work together, perhaps in a better way. All options are open, but those of us in the Labor Fight Back Network feel that our contribution is to be that kernel of change within the union, so that when things begin to move, and they are, that movement, that resistance is refracted and organized within the labor movement, within sectors of the labor movement. We have no illusions in the summit, in the tops. You know, there may be splits. There may be all sorts of new developments that occur. A lot of the resurrection that occurred in the 1930s was when a wing left the AFL to form the CIO and to fight for industrial unionism. There may be a wing that's going to have to leave and build independent working class politics or independent mass action. You know, there's all sorts of possibilities, but we're confident that, just as in the past, as you said at the beginning, there have been movements to resurrect in the past. We want to be part of that movement to help resurrect today.
Let me just comment on that point, because from my perspective, I think that's critical. If you look at the whole history of labor unionization in the United States, every time there's been a resurrection, it's been coordinated with a new form of organizational structure. At first, the unions were guilds and, you know, basically self-help organization, Knights of Labor and so forth in the 1850s and 60s. The Depression of the 1870s destroyed them. Out of that came the craft unions, the AFL, which were a new form and which were partially successful. World War II, the World War I crushed the craft unions. Industrial unions were forming, in the background from the railway union on, National Railway Union, and then the CIO, right, Congress Industrial Organizations. That was successful. But then the new employer offensive and the globalization of the capital and the destruction of the industrial manufacturing unions followed that. Every time you have a resurrection of labor, you have a new form of organization. And I think people in the union movement have to think hard about that. The whole business union thing has been a swamp. Right? It leads naturally, structurally, organizationally to this collaboration. Now we're in yet another major crisis, and I think the new strategies have to be associated with a new form of organization, and that organization has to somehow integrate the most militant elements of working class folks outside the unions in the communities with the most progressive elements that are still within what unions still exist. I think we have to start thinking not of we're going to resurrect the CIO. This isn't 1937. It's fundamentally different. And you need a new form of organization that will express and integrate, articulate, bring together these new forces that you've been talking about. It's true. Independent politics, the Richmond Progressive Alliance, all of the Medicare for all single payer, right, which the Democrats, of course, continue to scuttle at every opportunity, you know, both during the Sanders election and since the Sanders election. They will do everything to prevent Medicare for all. There are all of these movements that are occurring outside the union, and it's being reflected inside some of the unions. You know, I'm not saying it's a lost cause.
But not all of them, Jack, not all of them are outside the unions. This is very important. The labor campaign for single payer is in the unions. There are reform movements in the union. So I'm not with you on there has to be a total. I leave it open-ended. I believe, we believe we want to reclaim the unions. We believe that the union structures are not structurally the problem. I believe the problem is the misleadership. And we want to reclaim unions for struggle. And we cannot do that without creating structures of labor community partnership. Not to replace the unions, but to work with the unions. We think that the unions... And the history was not to substitute and to create something other than the unions. There's a big movement in Europe that says the unions are part of the problem and we have to, you know, ditch the unions, build new things. And
no, I'm not arguing that. I want to make it clear to you and to the listeners. I am not arguing ditch the unions. I am not saying replace the unions. I'm saying that the leading offensive edge will not be the unions because they are structured on this smokestack idea of occupation. Or
no, they might not be the leading
company, this company, or this industry, or whatever. I think that's part of the problem.
You're right.
And that you need to, without attacking that, it doesn't serve anything to attack that, okay? And to say it's wrong, get rid of it. Working folks aren't going to get rid of the protection they have. Which is the
we
only
want,
thing they have
we
are the
make
unions.
Unions work for us. We don't want to get rid. We don't
yeah,
want.
Yeah, but the unions, as they are structured now, are not working for them. On a national basis, they are no longer working.
It's because of the policies of the misleaders. It's not because
and
the unions
and
themselves.
And the policies of the misleaders are partly the cause of the structure, the organization, which allows them to be collaborationists to the extent they are. And if anyone resisted from below within the unions, they get squashed. You know, from Kerry to Wisconsin to all of these examples where resistance from below has been stifled and squashed.
Resistance from below is happening in the teachers' unions, Jack, and it's mushrooming. And it's not been fought.
I agree, but what happened in Wisconsin with the teachers union?
The teachers sold out. They sold
down
the
national leadership, took it over, redirected it back into the Democratic Party.
And they made a deal behind the backs. They made a deal behind the backs of their who were striking.
Unionism
and who walked out.
Will always do that. Business unionism always does that when it's a real resistance.
There's no question around it. So the new structures of organization within the unions to try to reclaim working outside. All I am saying is that the rank and file struggles that are developing are around let's reclaim our unions for struggle and not let's find other alternatives. Now, in the process of this, new forms are emerging. We're all open to those possibilities. I guess my only issue with you is that, and I agree that the unions aren't going to be the leading edge at this moment in this fight for resistance. But if we're going to have any real change, the working class and its organizations, the way that and reclaiming their organizations, are going to have to be a fundamental motor force in this. They cannot. The real change is not going to come by these movements isolated without the main bastions of the working class organizations taking center stage. And that's why we feel that we have a role, even if we're at this point, you know, just not the leadership, but we're going to have to help to get the labor movement to the point where it is part of the solution and not part of the problem. And that's going to take many forms. Some, it's going to be inside, it's going to be outside, it's going to be partnerships, it's alliances, it's going to be worker centers, there's going to be a whole series of new formations and current formations. We don't know what it's going to look like, Jack.
Well, I guess that's where you and I differ on this. I don't see the traditional union structure as being center stage and leading anymore. I think the best elements will follow at the local level, but I think the leading edge is going to be the working class outside organizing new ways of protest, demonstration, demands, and so forth. I mean, this movement for Medicare for All, single payer is an example. There's a lot of examples of that, and it eventually has to take an organizational form. It's not there yet. I'm not saying what that is, but it will. It will. And I think that will be the leading edge. And the unions, the best unions will be part of it, but many of the unions will resist it. They will resist
the
resurrection.
They will, but
they always have. Look at the whole history of the AFL in the previous resurrection back in the 20s and 30s. Totally resisted the creation of industrial unions. Totally opposed it.
Yeah. Of course they will, but there's enough rank-and-file movement in enough places that is saying we don't like what's happening, that you don't know. You cannot say in advance that they're not going to be able to take back their unions. That's all I'm saying.
Some of them they'll be able to take back, some of them at the local level, but my whole observation and personal experience for decades is that if the resistance and the democratization and the militarization of the rank and file reaches a certain point, the way the unions are structured and the laws back up the top leadership, you know, they will stifle it, just as they stifled it in Wisconsin.
They will do their best to do that. That's true. They will do their best, and there's no question about it. I believe me, I'm not prettifying anything. I'm just saying that I don't have the same unilateral assessment that you do. That's all.
Well, I wouldn't call it unilateral. I really wouldn't. As I've said here, it's not either or. Traditional structure or new structure, new movements, rank and file, grassroots, whatever, with the communities and so forth. The Richmond Alliance is a good example of that. I'm not saying it's either or, and I'm not saying ignore the traditional union structure or, what's even worse, oppose it. I mean, that you just become a handmaiden for the employers when you take that position. But I am saying that historically, and I mean in the recent period as well, that the unions, traditional unions, are not going to lead, even when you have aggressive rank-and-file progressive people in this union, that union, and so forth. It has to happen, and it will, and it is happening very early, but it is beginning to happen, I agree with you, outside. And that's where the focus really should be for progressives. And as that outside movement develops, you need to develop a new organizational structure to fit the new strategy, which includes the unions. But the unions aren't at the lead of this whole thing. They are part of the movement, but they aren't going to lead. And they're not going to lead, again, because the way the business union structure has evolved in this country, it is such that it is so integrated with the laws and so integrated with the collaboration, right, that anytime you get a real movement from below, it's easy to smash it. And they do smash
it. We're kind of going around in circles. I don't disagree that there's going to be an attempt to smash it. I'm looking at those forms of resistance that are occurring in the unions in North Carolina with Flock that want support and that want to build alliances with the community to support them. I'm looking to what we can do in our unions to look at the example of independent Black candidates like Devin Branch in East Cleveland for mayor, who's running on the Green Party ticket. He would have preferred running as an independent Black candidate, but he wasn't allowed to run as an independent. But that's neither here nor there. He is running and raising all the platform issues and looking for support from the unions and alliance with the unions on a working class platform. So there's a lot of wonderful developments, Jack, and we were very fortunate in Cleveland to hear people who are putting up fights around health care, around immigrant rights, around the attacks on Islamophobia. And so what we don't pretend that we're going to turn things around in the unions. We just want to be a catalyst within the unions for moving this forward at the level of the rank and file, at the level higher if we can, and building the alliances with the community that are going to be the key to moving and helping those in the unions move forward.
Sorry to intervene, but we're almost out of time. Why don't you tell the listeners where they can go to find out more about the program of the Labor Fight Back Network?
Yeah, go to our website, www.laborfightback.org, laborfightback1word.org, and you'll see the decisions of the Labor Fight Back Conference in Cleveland. And with its seven campaigns, a part two is going to be posted very soon with the keynote presentations by people like Dr. Margaret Flowers from, you know, fighting for single payer. Valdemar Velasquez talking about the challenges in Flock and what we can do. Chris Silvera talking to us about what is it going to take to build militant actions to beat back and defeat the federal right to work law. Clarence Thomas from the ILWU pointing to the examples of mass strikes and port shutdowns, which is going to be needed to show the power at the point of production, which labor has not done. And I couldn't agree with you more there in decades. Youth who are talking about independent politics and breaking with the Democrats or Bernie people. So I think we're a positive contribution. We don't want to pretend that we're anything other than what we are. It's a wing, a small wing, but we're fighting consistently around independent mass action, independent politics. And we've worked with you, Jack, over the years. We might have nuances. I don't think they're real differences. I think they're more nuances of, you know, how do we position ourselves right now. We're moving in the same, we're raising the same issues in the same direction, and we really appreciate the forum that you give us.
Okay, well, we got a signal here. Sorry, Alan, thank you so much for the excellent discussion here. And folks should go to laborfightback.org network to find out more about their program and their strategies. All right, I guess
thanks
we're out
so
of
much,
time.
Jack.
This one went so
thank
fast.
You. Great. Thank you.